This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the travel edition of Slate Money, your guide to travel, I guess. We have a very special guest on this week. I am Felix Salmon of Fusion. Anna Szymanski and Jordan Weissman, as ever, are here.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hello, but most importantly, we have Rafat Ali.
Hello.
Rafat, you run a publication called Skift.
Correct.
Skift is, it's a website, it's a magazine, which I have in my hand.
We did this hot new thing called print.
It's a hot new thing called print. The cover line on the magazine is Travel in an Age of Perm Anxiety, which
correct.
I didn't even know that perm anxiety was a word, but it seems right.
Well, we coined it. We love coining words or whatever they're called.
You're always create the trends. So this is going to be a very special edition of Slate Money during a time of the year that people spend altogether too much time in airports. If you're listening to this in an airport, my commiserations. If you're listening to this on a plane, which is also possible, I hope that we will be able to transport you out into a lovely world of not having to, you know, worry about that large person sitting next to you. Planes. We're going to talk about planes. We're going to talk about airlines. We're going to talk about the travel industry more generally and the way in which there's this kind of trade-off between these wonderful local people who are providing wonderful, valuable services on the one hand and these big global companies who seem to be extremely good at siphoning off all the profits on the other. But we're going to start with the one topic, which frankly, we could spend the entire episode just talking about this one thing, but we're going to pick and choose a couple of things about Airbnb, because Airbnb is the huge story in the travel business, has been for many, many years, is a really fascinating company, and people always are finding problems with it, issues with it. Let's start with the anti-gentrifiers. Is it true that Airbnb is taking lovely, cohesive community neighborhoods and turning them into transient populations of tourists and people who don't really care about like building a community?
Yeah, well, all of us live here in New York City. I mean, you know the story here. And so if you look at Alphabet City, for example, in Manhattan, chances are you'll find multiple people standing at the corner of streets with a luggage bag there. So It's a result of, obviously, Airbnb. I think Alphabet City is one of the biggest concentrations of Airbnb here.
And that's despite the fact that it's actually illegal.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
where it's legal, it's even worse, so anyways, right?
Yeah. So in many cities, especially city centers or places just off city centers where hotels typically are in the city centers, it's had an effect in cities like Paris, like New York, like Barcelona.
There were like literally riots in the street in Barcelona.
In Barcelona, this year has been, I mean, I think this year in Europe, certainly the summer this year, the summer of what we call over tourism, it's also a term we coined last year, has been the summer of over tourism in Europe, which is the big cities have been overrun by tourists.
And is that Airbnb's fault?
Here's what Airbnb would argue, that they allow people to be dispersed outside the main areas, because that's where the hotels typically are, the people stay. So people are outside in different communities in the city. You could also argue, and probably the numbers may bear this, which is that more people are, more people are traveling. That's an objective fact in general around the world. So, and hotel occupancy rates are holding up very well everywhere, pretty much. Which means that obviously there are new people coming into the market that are using Airbnb, which means that there are more people in a city. So, you know, if you take that to the logical extreme, of course they're having an effect.
Also, I'm curious, do they know if people who use Airbnb are more likely to use other like local services in the city? So then they may actually leave more money in the city than if you're staying at some Marriott or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair. I think that would be true. Airbnb has a lot of economic impact studies out there that they fund that essentially says that, which is that the local communities in Brooklyn or different parts of Queens, I live in Queens, Astoria, so the local places in Astoria. But then, you know, are you going to Starbucks in Astoria? Or are you going to a local coffee shop in Astoria?
I guess the question is basically, is this a good thing or a bad thing? Right now, we seem to be hearing from a lot of local populations in Barcelona and around the world saying this is a bad thing. For all that you guys might be bringing in lots of money and spending it in local coffee shops, those of us in Reykjavik or Barcelona, we don't actually want your money. We want you out of here and we want our community back.
I think that, as you very well know, minorities shouting the loudest always gets the most amount of attention. In this case, I would say that the majority net sentiment about Airbnb or tourists in a city, long term, either people don't give a shit or the local communities or the businesses do care about, obviously, these tourists being there. So I think that's a general, I would say that would be the general sentiment.
So local businesses love making more money.
Yeah.
There's a few loud opponents, and you're saying the general, if you actually look at the population as a whole, they maybe aren't so opposed as the headlines might suggest?
Yeah, I would say that's a general, and then there are exceptions like Barcelona, like Venice, that are there. I mean, New York City, we live here, as I said, like take your own sentiment. Do we, beyond a certain, I'm in the travel industry, so I do care, but if you're not thinking about travel the whole time, beyond a certain point, if you're not going to Times Square, do you give a shit?
Well, I have a question. So to Barcelona, are people there worried about gentrification, that people are being pushed out of their neighborhoods by people who are running boutique hotels?
So that's a real thing. So let's talk about the quality of life issue.
Yeah.
So the quality of life issue and gentrification is a real fear, but certainly related to the tourist issue. This is true in cities like Barcelona, in New York City, in Reykjavik, a city where it has the most concentration of Airbnb in the world. It just happens to be very small, but such that nobody can actually buy anything in Reykjavik downtown or the city. They're moving out. So certainly that would be the biggest issue.
Yeah.
Versus are there enough tourists or not? So I think that Airbnb certainly contributes to it. In a place like Boston, one of my very good friends, she owns a bunch of Airbnbs around Harvard. And I'm guessing those are apartments nobody's going to be able to buy, right? So
because she owns them and she's not selling them.
She's not. Well, she owns a bunch of it, essentially to Airbnb it,
right?
And to make tons of money off it. So, yes, of course. I mean, that's driving up the prices in many ways.
So, because the thing about over tourism that I guess confuses me a little bit is that typically people get angry when a neighborhood just gets reduced to a tourist destination, when it's just totally overrun and all of a sudden the things that were there before that catered to locals disappear. It seems like Airbnb, if you're going to almost is a fix for that in some ways, because if you were going to have more people traveling to these cities regardless, you would have to accommodate them somehow and you would have more hotels opening up. You would have the central tourist district.
The supply creates the demand. The reason why travel is up is precisely because
it's affordable, a lot more
you
affordable.
You can do it, especially now if you're traveling with kids. That was always very hard with hotels. Now that you can find Airbnbs and you can cook for them and it's much easier to travel with kids, that increases demand in an artificial way.
I think demand is not just Airbnb.
I think demand is low cost. So the biggest effect on demand and travel worldwide, like you know, Mark Anderson said, software ate the world, right? That whatever that phrase was. Guess what? Low cost airlines ate the world as well. So because they opened up a huge swaths of society to actually travel for the first time in their lives.
I was going to say, is that to me? It seems I'm a little skeptical of the idea that Airbnb is really driving this. It would be more like. I mean, my naive guess is you now have people in India and China who have low-cost airfares to get wherever they want in Europe. So that's what's going to be driving
Asia,
a lot of this.
In Asia, like Southeast Asia's story is a story. If you can, you know, look for the rise of AirAsia and the rise of Southeast Asia, it's sort of literally parallel to each other.
I was just looking at the tourist numbers in Seoul, which I have to admit, really considered
a tourist
destination. But the amount of tourists in Seoul is absolutely astonishing.
So it's funny. So last week I was in Malaysia for a conference about urban tourism. This was the whole conference I was in. And I'm still 5 days later, I'm still jet lagged, which is a whole different story. The guy who heads tourism for Seoul was there. They're actually doing the same conference, which is in Malaysia, next year in Seoul. So he gave a overview of why that's happening. So the story there is they're doing an urban regeneration of the city, which is essentially taking the High Line model and putting it to scale, which is all these unused ports or this or that and making them into tourist destinations. And we can talk about that. But High Line is probably the most copied urban innovation anywhere in the world.
And the High Line was itself a copy of a park in Paris.
Is that what it was? I didn't know.
But we made it famous.
So that's a big part of what's driving there, which is that they're trying to get the one of the big things they've done is to encourage travel within the locals, meaning as a city, by making the city a lot better for people to spend time in, not just in Seoul, but also the other Koreans. And then that has led to a larger influx of tourists from around the world.
Is this something that the broad population of Seoul likes and wants?
I don't know that level of detail, to be honest.
I mean, it's weird. Like, you find this a lot, is local tourist agencies and cities spending a lot of money and effort trying to create a tourist-friendly city, which is the flip side of you know what we were talking about earlier, which is people saying we want fewer tourists, is that there seems to be a bunch of places around the world, even in very rich countries like Korea, saying, no, we want more tourists. Can those two coexist? There does seem to be a tension there.
Yeah. I do think that net travel has a, you know, this is our world, so we think that travel has a beneficial effect on the world in so many ways. I think cities, one of the biggest sources of revenue is the taxes that they get from the tourists in so many different cities. So I think that the cities would tell you one thing and some of the locals will tell you another thing. What is happening 100% now is that historically the tourism organizations, the marketing people and the tourism in different cities and the economic development boards, which didn't used to interact ever, are now working together. in many cities. New York is a good, is a very good example of it, where they're trying to say, how do we make sure that the locals are satisfied as we do promote the tourists. It's certainly the intent is there. There are early efforts there in a lot of different cities around the world. So that's a new change that has happened that historically travel has not considered as part of its remit, which is we better make sure that the locals' lives are getting better, which never used to be the case.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
But let's pick up this question of low-cost airlines. These have transformed travel, you tell us, and certainly as a European, where we've had them in Europe longer than anyone else, that's unarguable. So I guess the question, I have a couple questions. One is like, when is this going to reach America?
So it has reached America in very different ways than you would imagine. So it's essentially the mainline airlines that are introducing what they call basic economy fares, which is really, really, really low cost. I think there was a story we did yesterday, maybe, or was it day before this week, that Delta is now marketing basic economy fares to Europe, really cheap fares, but you're going to pay $60 for a bag. This is the first time they're doing it. Internationally, because internationally, at least you were able to carry one bag, whatever thing you buy. So it's the first time. So the answer is, I don't think new startup low cost airlines will come into US anytime soon. The cost and the structure is just too expensive. But these mainline airlines realize that they have competition, obviously, here from Southwest, JetBlue, Allegiant, some of these other airlines, local airlines as well, low-cost airlines. So they're introducing this basic economy fare. So that's the way that is happening in U.S. In Europe, it's a different story. It's the low-cost airlines themselves that have eaten up the market. But BA is on record saying they're going to do a race to the bottom. They're going to cut the fares. They're going to cut the services. They're going to compete head-on against every other low-cost EasyJet, Ryanair. So in many ways, like Air France has launched a millennial-focused low-cost airline, which is total ridiculous.
Of course they have.
Serves avocado toast.
Costs
a lot.
The two things you're describing right there sound so different to me that it seems even hard to compare them, which is in Europe, you have a bunch of cut-rate airlines that have
been there for a long time.
Exactly, but they compete against the big guys, and they have brought down the prices sort of naturally.
Yeah.
Whereas in the U.S., with these basic economy fares, you know, when I look at them, it looks more like they're charging similar to what the old, like, lowest tier fare was, but now they're charging more for bags, essentially. It's just, it's less of an actual discount than it is a way to eke out a little bit more profit.
I think that's probably a fair assessment, yes.
So,
so how to get more, you know, it's the unbundling of, you know, cable that happened is happening in the airline.
I see what happened with JetBlue, which I think when it started could credibly have been called something vaguely akin to a low-cost airline, although with better service.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, whatever else you can say about it, it's not low-cost. It costs the same as everyone else. Yeah,
it's got a better app.
It does have a better... I mean, as a user, I would say it has... They're just better people that are servicing it. It looks like they're just more customer-friendly in so many different ways.
And what would you say are the biggest barriers to having those truly low-cost carriers in the United States?
So many different things. Airport landing slots are locked up by pretty much all the big airlines that are there. Norwegian is coming in on an international basis and trying to do what, you know, as you probably know, trying to do with secondary airports here.
Yeah, from,
in New
from
York
like
City,
Stewart to Edinburgh.
Like those, a 1.5 hour, 2 hour bus ride from here to get to Edinburgh, etc. So just the structural issues in the US are really, really hard in terms of airports just not being there for or certainly not in big hubs like
yeah,
in the big cities.
One of the interesting things about Europe is it's just a much denser continent, and there were a lot of underutilized airports which were still quite close to a lot of people. And that's less common in the US. There are an abundance of underutilized airports in the US, yeah, but they're just not near major population centers.
And also keep in mind, so in US, the airlines, the way they make money is not taking money from us occasional travelers. It's the business travelers and companies that have contracts with these giant companies that have contracts with Delta, United, American, et cetera, et cetera. So as long as they're being serviced, us transient travelers are a tiny part of their business compared to the larger business that they have. So and this is the challenge JetBlue has always had, which is they were never a business airline. So can they eke out a living by just those occasional travelers at scale? And they have had to, over the last at least, I would say, 3 to 5 years, have now gone heavy into trying to attract business travelers. They launched Mint, which is their first business class product, et cetera, for transcontinent flights. And so that's the challenge in the US, which is can you eke out a living outside of the business travelers? And in general, corporates try to stay away, have historically tried to stay away from low-cost airlines.
And that's why?
And that's...
Why have corporates stayed away from low-cost airlines?
Because all kinds of things. There's this phrase called duty of care, which is a very corporate travel phase, which is, are you able to provide enough services at, like, it's like an SLA. Are you providing X number of services to the people, whether you're staying at hotels or taking these airlines? Airlines may not have enough bulk capacity, these low-cost airlines, to work with a large company like, for instance, Accenture, which needs millions of seats in a year. So there's that. Those are some of the issues historically that have been there. And you would assume business travelers want higher class of service, or at least used to. Now, obviously, things are changing.
Also, just a level of certainty, and also the ability to change flights,
and also have enough routes. Because, like, if it's Accenture, for example, mm-hmm, you better have flights into every freaking place that right. their clients
Accenture,
are.
Accenture, McKinsey, all like, the
but, yeah. yeah. So they need to really have really wide coverage. Low-cost airlines are going from point to point most of the times.
And because this is Slate Money and we can never have an episode of Slate Money without talking about the transformative effect of China, what's the transformative effect of China? I've been looking at the yeah. Chinese tourism yeah. numbers, and they go parabolic.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I think they're close to 150 million new tourists every year, if I'm not mistaken. But this is the biggest topic in every part of travel, whether it's airlines, whether it's hotels, Airbnb. Airbnb's co-founder, Nathan, is spending now the majority of his time making sure China works for them as a business. And so the action is not so much international travelers going to China. That's actually not a growth area for them. The number of travelers going to China is actually falling. It's the external travelers and travelers within China, the local Chinese within China. There's just a huge amount of activity everywhere. Australia, the other day, the CEO of Tourism Australia was in our office, and this is his number one job, is to make sure China is happy or Chinese travelers are happy. That's the only thing he cares
for. And that's the question. Is that qualitatively different? As the travel industry starts pivoting to make sure that Chinese travelers are happy, whether it's airlines
yeah.
or anyone else, are they going to do things which they haven't done before?
Yeah, I think that's so there's some what you may call customer experience changes because it's a very different culture. So some of these are cliches, but let's run with them. Chinese travelers typically travel in groups, large groups. They are very attuned to shopping, which is what they want to do in many different locations they want to go. typically want to have access to food that they from their own cultures. So hotels have, and they need English, Chinese to English language translations, etc., so that people can understand them. So a lot of hotels have programs around that. All the big hotels at this point, I mean, this is 2018 almost, so everybody has been doing that for the last 5 to 7 to 10 years. Airlines have obviously done that quite a bit as well. Airbnb has done that. So yeah, this is true for pretty much every place in the world.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so we're going to spend the final segment here just talking about travel.
Yeah.
And
as a traveler.
As a traveler, there's... Jordan has a question about... as a selfish question about... Very, like,
extremely selfish.
He wants to maximize his hipsterdom.
Yes. So, well, no, okay. So as... you know, I like to try to travel every once in a while, yeah. But it feels like places that were cool and not mobbed maybe 1 year ago very rapidly are suddenly swarmed with tourists. And this is sort of like if you go to...
Well, the other side is also true, by the way. If you want to go to Syria, it's completely open at this point.
Thank you for the hot tips. booking as we speak for Damascus. So my question is, how do you figure out, before there's a New York Times 36 hours article that's going to ruin it for everyone, where is actually an interesting place to go that will not have just been totally demolished by a crush of tourists?
Well, here's the other thing. You would assume that by the time New York Times would write it, or as soon as they write it, it will get demolished.
Yeah.
I will tell you that that's not the case. If you had taken the Cuba example, everybody thought Cuba was going to be overrun by tourists. By now, it's not a secret by any stretch of imagination. Guess what? There are not that many Americans going. Every airline has cut the number of flights. So, and in Cuba, if you go outside literally 4 blocks of Havana,
yeah,
you will be able to find pretty much no tourists.
But that's all. Isn't Cuba a weird example, though, because they have such a lack of infrastructure and people are, when they get to Havana, are really shocked by what actually exists there. They're used to the photos where everything looks very picturesque, and then they find half a city that looks like it's been bombed out.
Well, so let's take Iceland. So that's okay. A better example.
Okay.
Iceland, by the way, the airport is structured, Reykjavik, one corner of the country. There's only one international gateway to the country, which they're trying to change. Certainly Reykjavik and anywhere south. Somehow people only drive south, turns out. south is completely overrun. You go north, literally 2 hours, 3 hours, it's empty still. This is a thing I've learned as part of just being a traveler and now the travel industry. Even overrun destinations literally are blocks. And
right.
Just,
and I can,
isn't it also yeah. certain weeks and certain months if you go outside of those yeah. times as well?
I mean, Croatia as an example. Croatia is, I mean, in summer is impossible, but any time else is empty. So if you want to do a honeymoon in Croatia, which a lot of people do.
Just don't go in August. But and the other thing which I would add is that, one, you're absolutely right, that it's not that hard to go a little bit off the beaten track. But two, it also depends on where you go, because I just had a lovely little trip to Charleston, and Charleston is totally covered in tourists. It's very much a tourist city, but it's none the worse for it. And there are places where tourists make a city worse, and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm just surrounded by these tourists. And actually, to a certain level, I can see somewhere like Barcelona is like that. And then there's places like Charleston where tourists really don't make it worse, or Santiago de Compostela, or places which manage to really celebrate and embrace the tourism, and it's fine. It's not a problem.
Well, I feel like mid-sized American cities that are known for their food scenes might be a slight exception. Like when you're talking about international travel, that might be also attracting like the Australian teenagers and the Chinese tourists. It's a little bit.
What we talked about low-cost airlines before. Anywhere where low-cost airlines are not yet flying,
okay,
is probably a good bet.
Anywhere where it's inconvenient and expensive.
It's inconvenient yet. Like my wife and I and our son, we only stay at an Airbnb because I have a son now. We don't stay at hotels anymore. We went to Faroe Islands. So Faroe Islands is really hot this year, which is the next Iceland is what everybody's talking about. But the reality is you literally go there and there's outside of some of the main areas, they don't really have any infrastructure to begin with. So, I do think that there's still tons of places that you can find, and they don't yet have a low cost airline. They're talking to different, airline groups. They are very worried that they will become another Iceland. They're wary of it. It's fascinating with the struggle they're going with, on this one.
So here's the big question which I wanted to ask you, and it applies very much to something like the Faroe Islands, is you spend a lot of time in your day job looking at the big companies which dominate a huge amount of the travel industry, whether it's Expedia, Priceline, Hotels.com, Google.
Right.
I've heard of them.
By many accounts, Google is larger than Priceline and Expedia and everything, just in terms of the travel.
Just Google revenue. Travel.
Yeah.
And the amount of money these companies make is absolutely mind-boggling. They're extremely profitable. They're worth hundreds of billions of dollars if you add them all together.
Yeah, certainly valuations-wise, yeah.
And yet, at the same time, when I'm traveling, I feel like I'm spending my money in like relatively local establishments. I stay in a local hotel. Even if I stay in a chain hotel, it's staffed up with locals. And I guess my question is, to a vague approximation, this money I'm spending, to what degree is it actually really helping the local economy? And to what degree is it just going into the coffers of Google and Priceline?
Well, in Google and Priceline's case, keep in mind they're only taking a cut on top of the actual thing, because they're not selling any travel products themselves that they own. It's
right.
It's hotels and airline tickets that they're selling. So that is a minority of the total revenue pie in general. Would really depend on what destination there is. In a city like Delhi, for example, a lot of international tourists are going, want to stay in relatively established brands. So probably a big part of international tourist revenue is going to established brands. This is just completely anecdotal analysis that I'm doing on the fly. In a city like New York, I would imagine outside of the business traveler that stays at a bunch of these hotels, a lot of the money is going to the local establishments as well. You would imagine that people are not coming to New York and getting Starbucks. Like, I hope they're not.
Oh, they are.
A lot of them are.
Well, but I also think it's important to remember that when you're talking about the money that tourism brings in, you're not just talking about lodging and the dining, but yet you're talking about
activities.
All the indirect dollars that are brought in. So that money isn't necessarily going to go to a Google or a Priceline.
Tours and activities, so the industry calls it, like, that is one part, as a huge part of it. It's a very unorganized, small business friendly sector. There are some big companies like the buses that take tourists around, but there are tons of other small little things as well. I think internet, for whatever other things it's done, it's also enabled a lot of these small entrepreneurs to sell their services through all kinds of sites and companies. Like, for instance, I was in, as I mentioned, Malaysia last week, KL, and in KL we did a food tour on this site called With Locals, which as the name says, essentially is locals offering their services to take you around the city. And we did a food tour. We did a Malay local food tour. And it was completely outside of the main tourist area. And this is almost, I would say, except for the commission that this site took, everything went to the locals.
The question I have is, like, has this changed?
I think as a responsible traveler, I think this is the frontier in terms of, if you're traveling, please try and spend money with local businesses. I think this is the next level of consciousness as a traveler.
And has the internet made that easier than ever?
I think so. I mean, in a country like Myanmar, probably not right now with all that's happening. But in a lot of other places, yes.
Like Syria?
It's there for anybody to research and find out. That's what I would say. It's there. The information is there. If I, as a responsible, somewhat sophisticated traveler, wants to do that, there are ways to do it.
Yeah, and so I think it's both easier for many tourists to be responsible. And I also think that tourism itself generates lots of capital investment. Tourism itself generates taxes, as you were saying, that from airport fees, hotel fees, that then goes to potentially pay for roads and schools and these kind of things. So I think when we're thinking about tourism, we shouldn't necessarily just think about
just the travelers and the hotels and the airlines and stuff. Yeah, it's by many accounts the world's largest industry, which is why we do what we do.
Wonderful. This was amazing. Thank you very much, Rafat Ali, for coming on to Slate Money. Thank you, all of you guys, for listening to Slate Money. Keep the emails coming at slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Dan Schrader and June Thomas, who somehow between them managed to produce this show. Go listen to Trumpcast, which is now coming out at least 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, sometimes more, because there's no shortage of Trumpish news. That's Jacob Weisberg, Virginia Heffernan, Jamel Bowie, talking all things Trump. It's worth listening to. But we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.